Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast series of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Welcome to Central Line. I'm your editor and host, Dr. Adam Stryker, back again today with Dr. Vaibhav Bora, member of the ACE editorial board. Dr. Bora is joining us for a dive into the timely topic of GLP-1 agonists, a topic that appears in the 21A issue of ACE, out now. This is one of those topics everyone is talking about. Many of our listeners are, I'm sure, very familiar with at this point. So I'm looking forward to this conversation, and hopefully we can shed a little more light on this class of drugs and also hopefully provide a little bit of current information to our listeners. So Dr. Bora, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Dr. Stryker, for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, great. Before we get into the topic, as we often do on Central Line, do you mind just telling us a little bit about yourself so our listeners get to know you, know a little bit about your background and how you got involved with the ACE program?
Absolutely. So I'm an associate professor and director of critical care division with the Department of Anesthesiology and Perioperative Medicine at Medical College of Georgia in Augusta. My expertise lies in critical care and cardiac anesthesia, and I'm board certified in both these specialties. In my role as an academic physician, I'm involved in educating residents, critical care fellows, and medical students. Throughout my career, when I was a resident and a learner, I was relying on ACE program to expand my knowledge and to prepare for the exams. And as an attending, I used it for CME credits. And I found it to be an invaluable resource. And joining ACE editorial board was my way of giving it back to our specialty and contributing to the education of our current and future physicians. And being a part of ACE committee allows me to continue my own learning journey while helping to shape a valuable resource for anesthesia professionals worldwide.
Excellent. Well, and on Central Line, as some of our listeners know, we often tackle a specific topic from the current issue of ACE. And this one, I think, is pertinent because of how much lay press this class of drugs has gotten recently. But importantly, it has effects on our patients when they present for anesthesia. So I think it's a very timely topic for a couple reasons. I think unless any of our listeners have been hiding in a cave for the past year or so, I suspect most of our listeners will have heard about the success of these medications, the GLP-1 agonists. But just in case, the drugs we're referring to are drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy. Why don't we start with how efficacious these drugs are? How do they work? What is the mechanism of action? And why are they so effective?
So the GLP class of drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy, what you call them by their trade name, they exert their effect by lowering the glucose. As we know that the glucose control in body is managed by an integrated hormonal system. These medications, they are a class of medications called glucagon-like peptide. These are also the human incretin hormone, which are involved in linking the nutrient, which are absorbed from the gastrointestinal tract, with the release of another incretin hormone called GIP. And these hormones link the absorption of nutrients with the secretion of insulin from the pancreatic cells. The GLP-1, in particular, enhances the glucose-dependent insulin secretion, meaning it stimulates the pancreas to release insulin in response to the rising blood sugar levels. Additionally, they have several additional effects, like delaying the gastric emptying. So GLP class of drugs slow the rate at which food moves through the stomach into the small intestine. This delay helps to regulate the release of nutrients into the bloodstream and preventing rapid spikes of blood sugar level after the meals. This class of drug also reduces the postprandial glucagon, which is another hormone which is produced by the pancreatic alpha cell that acts to increase the blood sugar level. So GLP receptor agonists help to reduce the release of glucagon, thereby lowering blood sugar levels after the meal. They also have a central effect. They decrease the appetite and the food intake, which can lead to weight loss in certain individuals. And thus, these medications are also used for management of obesity or weight management. So these GLP class of drugs, they can be in three categories. These are GLP-1 receptor agonist, the dual-acting GLP-1, and the GIP, which is glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide agonist, or the DPP-4 inhibitors, which is dipeptidyl peptidase inhibitors. So these are the three classes of drugs which fall in this category. Now, they are particularly appropriate in diabetes management alongside other diabetic medications like metformin. They are specifically useful and they are, have proven their efficacy in the current literature, at least about efficacy in prevention of atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease in these diabetic patients. And diabetes, as we know, is a very prevalent disease in the United States. They also decrease the glycated hemoglobin. And like we discussed, they are also used for weight loss. The good thing about them is they do not cause hypoglycemia until they are also combined with another hypoglycemic drugs for diabetes management. So this is what it makes them a very attractive drug for people who are diabetics, specifically type 2 diabetics, obese people, and people who have a combination of type 2 diabetes, obesity, and atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease.
What about tirzepatide? That works a little bit differently. Do you mind talking a little bit about that one specifically?
Certainly. So the tirzepatide is a novel medication, which somewhat differs from the other GLP-1 agonists because it's a combined GLP-1 and GIP agonist. So that gives it a little bit of a different mechanism. Like other GLP-1, the tirzepatide stimulates GLP-1 receptors, leading to increase in insulin secretion, decrease in glucagon secretion, and slowing the gastric emptying and a feeling of satiety. However, it also targets the glucose-dependent insulinotropic polypeptide, the GIP receptor, resulting in an additional glucose-lowering effect. So it acts by two mechanisms. The dual receptor agonism kind of increases the efficacy of this medicine as compared to the traditional GLP-1 receptor agonists. In clinical trials, tirzepatide has produced superior reduction in hemoglobin A1C levels and body weight reduction compared with other GLP and certain other anti-diabetic medicines. Typically administered subcutaneously, and what makes it somewhat attractive is it is once a weekly dosing, similar to other long-acting GLP-1 agonists. However, its potency may allow for a lower dose as compared to the traditional GLP-1 receptor agonists, while achieving a similar or a superior glycemic and weight loss outcomes. Overall, it has demonstrated a favorable safety profiles and a side effect similar to those observed with other GLP-1 receptor agonists, like the GI symptoms and transient increase in heart rate and rare cases of pancreatitis. However, in the initial trials, it has been pretty safe and much more effective as compared to the other similar medications.
What brand names should we be looking for? You mentioned several subclasses of these medications. As anesthesiologists, which ones should we keep an eye out for?
So one of the things which we kind of, as a perioperative physician, deal with is these newer classes of medications, and we need to know their brand names as well, because sometimes our patients or the other providers may refer to them by the brand names. So GLP-1 receptor agonists, these are a relatively newer class of drugs. First one was exenatide, which was approved in 2005. It comes with a brand name Bydureon. It's a subcutaneous injection, which is given twice daily. Then the second one is liraglutide. It was sponsored in 2010. It comes with a brand name Victoza. It's administered as once daily subcutaneous injection. Then we have albiglutide. It was introduced in 2014 with a brand name Tenzium. It's given once a weekly subcutaneous injection. We have dulaglutide with a brand name Trulicity. It is administered as once weekly subcutaneous injection. We have lixisenatide, which was introduced in 2016 with a brand name Lixiumia adlycan, and it's given as once a daily subcutaneous injection. Semaglutide was introduced in 2017 with a brand name Ozempic for diabetes, and Wegovy for obesity. It is administered as once a weekly subcutaneous injection for diabetes and once a weekly subcutaneous injection or oral tablet for obesity. The newest one is tirzepatide with the brand names Mounjaro for diabetes and Zepbound for obesity. It's given as once a weekly subcutaneous injection for diabetes and once a weekly subcutaneous injection for obesity. Now, these brand names may vary depending on the region and the country, and it's important to be familiar with the different brand names for accurate prescribing and for anesthesiologists as a perioperative physician to know what was the drug, what was the doses, and when was the last time the patients may have been taking these medications?
Well, that's a specific area I do want to talk about. Before we get to that, though, let's talk a little bit about how these agents interact with insulin. Is there anything that we need to know specifically about that interaction?
So the GLP receptor agonists, they interact with insulin and play a crucial role in glucose homeostasis, like we talked about, these being the incretin hormones, which are secreted from the intestinal cells. So they stimulate the insulin secretions from pancreatic beta cell. So GLP receptor agonist stimulates the insulin secretion from the pancreatic cell in a glucose-dependent manner. They enhance the insulin release when blood glucose levels are elevated, but their effect diminishes as the glucose levels normalize, helping to prevent hypoglycemia. They inhibit the glucagon secretion as well. So they suppress the release of glucagon, which is a hormone that raises the blood glucose level, by promoting glycogen breakdown and gluconeogenesis in the liver. By inhibiting the glucagon secretion, these reduce in the hepatic glucose production and they maintain glucose level within a normal range. These GLP receptor agonists, they also promote satiety and they improve the beta cell function. Some literature about long-term treatment with GLP agonists have been associated with improved beta cell function and preservation of pancreatic beta cell mass. They also complement the action of insulin. So when used alone or in combination with other diabetic medications like insulin, they lower the insulin requirement and they reduce the weight gain, which is associated with the insulin therapy. And they improve the glycemic control at the same time without increasing the risk of hypoglycemia. So overall, they play a multifaceted role in regulating glucose metabolism by enhancing insulin secretion, inhibiting glucagon release, slowing gastric emptying, promoting satiety, and improving the beta cell functions.
Let's talk about side effects. We know there are some. What should we be on the lookout for? And what patient populations might be more apt to see those side effects?
Now, when we are talking about these medicines, it's crucial to acknowledge that they can be really beneficial in many patients in terms of glucose control and weight loss. However, like with any other medication, there are some things which we need to keep an eye on. First of all, the gastrointestinal side effects are quite common with GLP-1 receptor agonists. We're talking about things like nausea, vomiting, abdominal discomfort. Now, there's some literature that these effects, they do ease up and the patients develop, in a way, tachyphylaxis to these side effects over a duration of time. However, these can be very bothersome in some patients, especially when they are starting out on these medications. Then there's an issue with hypoglycemia. We know that GLP-1 receptor agonists tend not to lower the glucose, blood sugar, but when combined with other diabetes medicines like sulfonylureas or insulin, they can add up to the risk of developing hypoglycemia. Some patients can have injection site reactions, which may range from redness, swelling, itching to anaphylaxis kind of reaction. And then there's a risk of, in a patient who have a history of pancreatitis, of precipitating an episode of hemorrhagic or non-hemorrhagic pancreatitis. It's also people who are allergic to them, they can develop severe allergic reactions. And one thing that you need to keep an eye on. There's also some literature about more serious side effects like thyroid C-cell tumors. Now, these are rare, but they are important to be aware of. And patients should be informed about the signs and symptoms of serious diseases like pancreatitis and the thyroid cancers when they are being initiated on these drugs. Finally, we need to be cautious with these agents in patients who are having kidney problems to start with, and the dose adjustments may be needed to avoid more side effects from these drugs in these patient populations.
Are there specific patient populations, patients with diabetes that are on these medications versus patients that are on them for non-diabetic reasons? Do we have a different set of concerns when it comes to perioperative care of these patients, or is it the same list of things we should be concerned with and the same guidelines we should be following when it comes to the withholding of these medications?
So in terms of the perioperative management, in June, the ASA's Task Force on Perioperative Fasting put out a consensus-based guidance for perioperative physicians and providers for management of these patients who are taking the GLP-1 receptor agonist drugs. So according to the ASA guidelines, if it's an urgent or emergent case and we find out that these patients are taking the medications, then we still will proceed because it's an urgent and emergent case with full stomach precautions. I will consider rapid sequence induction or like putting an NG tube before intubation, or in cases where awake intubation is a possibility to avoid any risk of aspiration. When it comes to elective procedures, the recommendations are pretty clear in terms of the patients taking the GLP agonist should consider discontinuing them on the day of surgery if they are taking it on a daily dosing basis, and a week before if the patients are taking those ones which are dosed on a weekly basis. Regardless of whether the patient is taking a GLP-1 agonist for type 2 diabetes or weight loss, and regardless of the procedure they are undergoing, these guidelines stay the same. Now, discontinuation may sometimes lead to hyperglycemia during perioperative period. So when discontinuing these drugs, an endocrinologist should be involved in the decision-making to bridge the gap. On the day of the procedure itself, if the patients are taking the GLP receptor agonist, it's recommended, in order to avoid the risk of pulmonary aspiration of gastric content, that we take a thorough history and physical examination, looking for the signs of severe nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and considering a gastric ultrasound when patients have discontinued that thing. In fact, from a personal experience, I would say we had this patient there which was on these GLP agents, and they had some nausea and vomiting, and doing a stomach ultrasound led us to kind of cancel the case on the day of surgery, because even though they followed the same NPO guidelines, there was a significant amount of gastric residual material because of the delayed gastric emptying from these agents. So since it was an elective case, we ended up rescheduling the case and holding it for a little bit.
Well, just to follow up on that specific case, just out of curiosity, I assume they continued to withhold the medication for the rescheduling. Is that right? The one you're talking about? Were they rescanned then with another ultrasound when they presented again?
Definitely. So at our institution, we kind of have made it a pre-op habit where if they are tagged with these agents, we have a set of providers who are comfortable doing the gastric ultrasound, and we are training our entire department to do that, where we would do a gastric scan before these patients, they are going for an elective procedure. Now, for an emergent procedure, we have to kind of just proceed with the case with the full stomach precautions. But for elective cases, that is what we are trying to use based on the ASA recommendations. For this particular case, we were fortunate enough that the surgeon had a scheduled available next week, and we were able to squeeze them in, and we left them off of their medications for the duration, and called an endocrinology consult to bridge the gap with some sliding scale insulin.
Well, this leads into the question I was going to ask, which is, from what I understand, there are a lot of logistical hurdles here when it comes to scheduling these patients for surgery and having, especially on the ones that have the non-daily dosing of these medications and canceling cases, rescheduling. I work in the pediatric population. We're starting to see some of this, but it's obviously more prevalent in the adult population. And I wanted to get your take on the logistical concerns, because when I was just at a meeting recently, this was a topic of discussion, and there seems to be concern from the anesthesiologists on the current ASA guidelines, and is it too conservative? Is it adequate? And so I guess I'm asking a two-part question. A, what's your take on the overall anesthesia community and the logistical hurdles involved? And B, is this the most current up-to-date information regarding the medication and the discontinuation intervals?
Yeah, so this was one of the official guidelines from ASA. So for now, we have to follow them. But these are the newer class of drugs, and it's a newer thing which is introduced. And the specific risk of aspiration, we know that it's a very bothersome, and it can cause significant morbidity and mortality. So as a perioperative physician, you know, our foremost goal is to do the safest things for our patients. So we have developed a system in our pre-op clinic here that the patients get tagged when they are taking these medicines, and the first time when they are seen either by the surgeon's office or by the pre-op clinic. And they communicate a lot between the surgical scheduling and the anesthesia scheduling, so we can hold these medicines. If it's a long duration, we will have the endocrinology involved to bridge them. But if it's something which can be scheduled based on the surgical scheduling and timing from when the patients are taking it, we proceed with the procedure. So far, we have had our logistical glitches. So that's why, as a second layer of safety defense, what we have tried to do is train most of anesthesiologists in the point of care gastric ultrasound. And at least we have developed a core team of physicians who can do the gastric ultrasound. It's pretty easy to perform. And we have had a recent success in terms of, we haven't had any so far, knock on wood, aspiration events with these particular cases. And we were able to avert some of them by using the point of care ultrasound. So with the guidelines we have in our hands right now, the ASA guidance, and it will get updated. And like we discussed before, that some patients do develop tachyphylaxis to the gastric emptying and the decrease in gastric motility. But having a gastric ultrasound immediately before the procedure always gives us that another layer of safety, as these people may still have a full stomach, even though they have followed the prior guidelines or guidelines on a patients who are NPO guidelines on patients who are not on these agents.
In your experience using gastric ultrasound, do you feel like maybe the guidelines are not conservative enough? Are you seeing a lot of patients that are coming through with residual volume in the stomachs under ultrasound?
Yeah. So like most of these people are also having diabetes, which is another risk factor for gastroparesis. And they may be obese, which may be another factor which we need to consider in terms of intubation. So it becomes a decision which has, we have to integrate a lot of factors in terms of the logistics of the things, in terms of the patient's safety. And the foremost thing becomes the patient's safety. So if we look out for it, I believe at this point, the best option we have is to look at the ultrasound and see if the stomach looks like it's, there's some material in there, then we still will proceed with the rapid sequence induction and the aspiration precautions. It at least gives us a pre-test probability, if I may say, that is it safe to proceed or not? And that can be very helpful in multidisciplinary decision-making, whether to proceed with the case or not.
Right. In your experience with seeing these patients and then doing the gastric ultrasound, are you seeing a lot of them with residual volume where you feel like maybe you should be pushing out the discontinuation of the medication even further?
Yeah, so my experience personally has been a mixed one, because it also depends if the patients were on these medications for a long time. Then I have not seen a whole lot of, especially if they followed the advice given by the preoperative clinic and they were able to stop it, and we did not see a whole lot of gastric volume. And in one or two patients, I have seen that they, even after stopping it on that time, they still had the gastric volume. So it's very dependent on the patient, and we have to tailor the management on every particular patient, because their response may be different. And there's definitely a lack of the randomized trials yet to see like what would be a perfect guideline. And we all know in the medicine, there's nothing which follows the textbooks. So safety always comes first. So probably like I would still continue to do a gastric ultrasound in these patients who are on these medicines or at risk of aspiration, to give myself another layer of confidence and comfort taking care of these patients.
Well, let's change the direction just a little bit. We know these drugs have off-label use. What is the potential for abuse of these medications? And is there anything specific to that aspect of the utilization of these medications that we as perioperative physicians need to be aware of?
So we know the phenomena of drug misuse and abuse for weight loss purposes have frequently been reported in the literature. There's a thing called the image and performance enhancing drugs. So these are a wide range of drugs across various pharmacologic categories, which are misused to obtain an alteration or enhancement of the physical performance or appearance, as it occurs with the slimming products. GLP-1 agents, they do have a potential to be abused or sometimes used off-label for these indications. And now that we are in a world of social media, there is a potential that people who are image cautious or performers, they may use it. And these are non-medically prescribed drugs. So that's one thing which we have to kind of keep an eye on when we go through our substance abuse history during a preoperative evaluation. This is one of the things which we may have to consider some subset of patient populations. In terms of monitoring and education, it's also crucial for us to kind of keep a close eye on the prescribed ones, and the physicians who are prescribing it may sometimes give us a head up if the patient is using more of these medicines, if there's a regulatory issue around the prescriptions, refills, etc.
Well, before I let you go, let's just talk a little bit about how this topic was chosen for ACE. I mean, I know the timeliness and it makes perfect sense, but the mechanism of choosing a topic such as this and just reviewing how the decisions are made in general, what to include in the ACE program.
Sure. ACE stands out as an invaluable resource over years for anesthesia professionals. The questions and each edition of ACE is spearheaded by a dedicated 12-member editorial board comprised of clinical anesthesiologists from diverse backgrounds and diverse practice profiles to ensure that the content remains clinically relevant, accurate, and clear. We have quarterly meetings at the ASA headquarters where we meticulously select the content, review it before the meeting, and then we review it all the content during the meeting to refine the content, aiming to deliver the highest quality educational material. From its inception since 2004 to its current available version in 2024, almost 20 years of ACE program, ACE has proudly evolved into one of the solid foundation material for many practicing anesthesiologists around the world. As a part of editorial board, we are committed to enhancing ACE value by incorporating sophisticated clinical scenarios, content which is aligned with the currently published guideline, to say so, like the walking content, which an anesthesiologist should know, taking care of these people day in and day out. With the upcoming release of issue 21A, anesthesia professionals will have an opportunity to deepen their knowledge and earn valuable CME credits. We release two editions every year, one in April, one in October, with 30 CME credits each. And talking about the process of selecting the items for ACE Bank, it's a meticulous endeavor. It prioritizes the relevance, accuracy, and the educational value. We carefully choose the topics that align with the anesthesia practice, drawing from reputable sources, well-published books, crafting questions that reflect real-world clinical scenarios. We, as an editorial board, work on clarity, precision, and user engagement. It's a very important part of our process. We get feedback from our subscribers, and based on that, we modify the content as needed for our future issues. In summary, ACE is dedicated to delivering a high-quality educational content tailored to the needs of our anesthesia community and practicing anesthesiologists. And as a member of the editorial board, I'm proud to contribute to this mission and help anesthesia professionals to stay forefront in terms of knowledge in their field.
Excellent. Well, Dr. Bora, thanks for joining us today to not only discuss the specific topic, but also give us some more insight into the ACE program.
Thank you. It was an honor to be here.
Absolutely. And for our listeners who are interested in checking out more of the ACE program, go to the website asahq.org/ACE. If you like the podcast, feel like you're learning something from it, tell a friend about it, drop a review on your favorite podcast platform, and tune in again next time. Take care.
You can't read everything, so C does it for you. Learn what the specialty is learning on your own time. C is available now with insights from journals from around the world. Try a sample question at asahq.org/SEE. Subscribe to Central Line today wherever you get your podcasts, or visit asahq.org/podcasts for more.